All right, hang on. Okay, we're going to do an ad, and I'm going to get this in one take. All right, so Google, Apple, Intel, Pinterest, Nest, and Uber will all be on stage, and so will VCs from your favorite firms like Forerunner, Cowboy, Shasta, Trinity, and DFJ. And what would Disrupt SF be without a Golden State Warrior on stage? Well, this time Kevin Durant will be joining us too. But perhaps the best thing of all is that your favorite little podcast, this one, will be doing a live show. That's right. So Katie Roof, Lindley, and myself will be recording Equity for a live audience on Wednesday, September 18th at noon on the second stage. So come watch what we do for you. If you haven't gotten your ticket yet, head over to TechCrunch.com/DisruptSF and enter the promo code Equity, EQUITY. If you can't spell it, Google it. If that doesn't help out, Google it again. At checkout and get $1,000 off the price of general admission, which is kind of a bonkers discount. I've been told to read this, but that's still a surprisingly high number. So come hang out with us, boo us, whatever you want to do. We will see you all there real soon.
Coming up on Equity, Roku revealed its IPO filing. We broke the news that 23andMe raised a big round of funding and Juicero shuts down. Welcome to Equity. I'm TechCrunch's Katie Roof, joined by my colleague, Matthew Lindley.
Hello, audience.
Crunchbase News Editor-in-Chief Alex Wilhelm.
Hey.
And our special guest this week is Micah Rosenbloom, Managing Partner at Founder Collective.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us. Appreciate having you here. Got a fun week. One company we're not talking about. We won't say its name, even though Micah's an investor in it.
Yeah, I think we put ourselves through enough.
It's a four-letter word. Literally, it is a four-letter word.
But there is some big news out this week, which is that Roku dropped its S1. So at last, we got to look into this relatively old company's numbers. And there was a bit of nuance to them. So I'm going to hit a couple of high notes here and then let Katie talk about whatever I forget, because I'm sure there's going to be something. But up top, they filed for a $100 million IPO, which is kind of a placeholder number.
Yeah, so it means nothing for those of you who follow IPOs.
It means literally nothing. They could have just written a big X or a smiley face, and so we don't know if it's going to go up or down, but it's going to be a sizable IPO.
But yeah, I mean, it means it's not a billion-dollar IPO, because then they have to put a larger number on there, but it could also mean it's like $180 million or $80 million. It's very imprecise, to say the least, but
I suppose
they're doing
it's
an
a
IPO.
Ballpark. Yeah.
They're doing an IPO, and that's exciting because they've been talking about it for a while.
Very much so.
Reuters had been breaking news about them since like 2014 doing an IPO, so now it's real because they revealed their filing. So what were some of the numbers?
Some of the numbers are interesting. So in the first 6 months of 2017 through June 30th, they had $199.7 million in revenue, which was up from $162 million in the first half of 2016. Now, that's not the world's most amazing growth number, but what's going on inside the revenue mix is really important. So their player revenue actually went down from the first half of this year compared to the first half of 2016. The actual physical hardware that they sell, sales of that are essentially flat or down slightly. But importantly, platform revenue, which is money they derive from people watching stuff on the Roku platform, either through revenue share, advertisements, or other ways they make money, went up from $43 million in the first half of 2016 to $82.4 million in the first half of 2017. And why do you... Well, pivot to a sense, but why do we care? Only because there's no gross profit in their player business, and there's a ton of gross profit in their platform business. So their growing revenue stream makes all the money. And that means the company has a good growth story to tell investors, and that's why it can go public, even though it's not growing as much as you would otherwise expect.
No, I mean, I remember these guys like back in, I feel like this is one of the first stories that I ever covered at a tiny, tiny blog as a, I wouldn't call myself a journalist, but whatever you want to call it, coming out of college, right? Covering technology, where I went to this like hotel room where they had a Roku set up and it was playing Angry Birds with a motion controller. And I was like,
what year was that?
This is in 2010. That is how long this company has been around and how long they've been doing TV things and like playing with Wii technology, basically. But this is a company that was founded in 2002. So when I was playing Angry Birds in that hotel room, it was already 8 years old. And it has raised over $200 million from various firms and, you know, popular with millennials, I guess.
We're millennials. Don't make fun of millennials.
Yeah. I am a self-hating millennial, but
that's the best type.
This is a company that beat everyone to creating some kind of, you know, novel media platform for TV. You know, Chromecast came after it. Apple TV came after it. Fire is still a thing. The Amazon one came after it, and all the other like various.
And there's a lot of skeletons that never made
it. Yeah, it's a graveyard, right? Like, and the fact that, you know, okay, fine, they finally have a business that allows them to go public, and Wall Street's interested, but. God, this company is like 15, 18 years old, and it is still around, and it is now going public because 15 years later in its life, it has found a business that is actually really, really apparently profitable.
And they,
well,
smart, too.
Well, not profitable. They're not profitable yet, but they
have gross raised, profit, whatever.
They've raised over $200 million in funding. Their largest shareholder is Menlo Ventures. It 35.3% stake. So that's a pretty big stake, especially for at the time of an IPO. Fidelity owns 12.9%, 21st Century Fox, 7%. So yeah, I mean, they have a lot of investors here. Well, what do you think? There's a competitive landscape. It's no longer just Roku. I mean, Google has Chromecast. There's so many different devices. I mean,
I have an Apple TV, and I feel like that's old school now. Like, whenever I fire it up, my friend's like, oh my gosh, really? It's a 2014? I'm like, rude. I like this thing.
But I feel like this market has been threatening to be sorted out for the last 10 years, right? Like, I feel like, you know, the skinny bundle, it was all going to get easy, and yet it's still, like, totally fragmented. I have an Apple TV in one room. I have a Roku in another room. We've used Chromecast. Like, it still feels very fragmented and unclear exactly how it's all going to play out. So it's an interesting timing to do an IPO, and I'm curious, like, what they say to the street in terms of, like, how this all plays out long-term.
Yeah, I mean, it's like this was an industry that was supposed to have consolidated, totally. Like, 5 or 10 years ago, right? And I guess you could go into your roadshow and be like, hey, you know how this industry was supposed to have been consolidated 5 years ago? It still hasn't, and we have 10 million plus people. So I don't know, but...
Well, there's definitely a lot of cord cutters out there. There's no question that millennials are no longer buying cable TV packages. They're not paying those monthly bills. Instead, they're doing Netflix, Roku, Apple TV, Chromecast, whatever. There's a lot of them, and Hulu. They're definitely not subscribing to traditional forms of media. So they're definitely betting on a growing market here. I think the question is just what share of the market they will have. Also, it's growing all over the world, but there's a lot of competition.
I think it's
ultimately
also like,
boils down to that. Yeah.
It's also like what ecosystem are you going to buy into? Because I think what's hard for Roku is they're not in one of the big ecosystems. You know, you got the Google, you know, the Google system, Amazon and Apple, and they don't neatly fit. And I think there's probably a lot of customers who don't want to sign up to one of those ecosystems. But I think most people already feel like they're in one. And so why not just buy the Google Home and the Chromecast, and they've got their photos and everything else.
Brand loyalty.
Yeah.
Ecosystem lock-in.
Yeah.
That's it.
Digital handcuffs.
Yes. Yeah, the other more sinister version of brand loyalty.
Well, there's a monopoly word, which is probably even the worst. But.
I believe it's called jail.
But yeah, the timing of the IPO filing means that they're actually probably going to go public later this month. These days because of the Jobs Act, which we've mentioned on our show before, about 15 days before the roadshow is when companies almost always reveal their filings.
I wanted to add one quick thing about Katie's point earlier about how much they can drive in terms of usage, because they had some numbers in their S1 that I thought were really cool. And they drove their active accounts from 4.4 million at the start of 2014 to 15.1 million in the second quarter of 2017, while driving up their ARPU on that user base from 380 to 1122. So they've both managed to grow their ability to make money on a per user basis as they've scaled their users. And so when we talk about lock-in and where they fit into this landscape, they're driving a kind of a different path forward that I think is really cool. And it proves that you don't have to sell to a large incumbent to succeed, at least in this business.
So why is that though? Like why do we think they're making more money off each user?
Because they play with all the players. I mean, they have ad incomes, they have partnership incomes, and they're trying to expand both of those to eke out more dollars per minute. It's really hard. It's taking a long time. The iterative process you can see in their results implies that they've been grinding this out, but they've been around for, you said, 150 years. So, you know, I'm not surprised.
1.7 million years.
Oh, there we go. 1.7 million years. But they pulled it off. And so I'm just proud that they actually kept driving at this and didn't get stuck to their hardware business and actually pulled off a different ramp in the last 3 years.
It's almost as if a company that has diverse revenue streams has found a way to go public.
Unlike TechCrunch.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Just a matter of time. Breaking news.
Actually,
S1 by TechCrunch.
Actually, we are owned by a public company, Verizon.
Reverse IPO.
but but actually, what I was starting to say earlier is there's another company that we hear doesn't want to IPO just yet, so they're raising more funding. 23andMe?
Yes, the genetics startup, which I've been told by 17 million people to try at some point. I'm not going to.
You
Sorry.
Should try it.
Turns out you're related to all of them.
It's like, ah, that was the story all along. No, so after frantic afternoon where my phone was blowing up, TechCrunch broke the story that 23andMe raised about $200 million in capital. You know, we heard from sources all over, literally all over the world.
We had a lot of sources on this.
Sources literally all over the world that they were raising at a $1.5 billion pre-money valuation, and which is, you know, it's a big step up from their last one, which I think was like around a little over 1 billion.
Yeah, yeah. So roughly 50%.
Yeah, but I mean, it's also interesting because this is a company that has, you know, as a genetics testing company and all these other things, but like, my God, it also survived the wrath of the FDA for several years and like grounded out. And
if
now
you can survive that, you can survive the public market.
Yeah. Someday. And so, you know,
they make the taxi lobby look like nice.
Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, now it's like, okay, we're done. We're good to go. Our product's going to the market. People are going to start using it. So let's raise a ton of money. So they got money from Sequoia. They got money, I think, from Fidelity.
Yeah.
If I'm remembering correctly.
It's interesting because they actually hadn't really gone the VC route as much. They have money from NEA, but they have investors like Johnson & Johnson, Genentech. It's definitely a different kind of list that we normally see. I mean, they have Google and Google Ventures, but for the most part, they have other types of equity investors in their company. But, you know, they've got to keep raising money if they don't want to IPO yet. And it makes sense that you wouldn't want to IPO right after getting over this whole FDA debacle.
Have you used this yet, Micah?
So I haven't. My wife has. And I'm a little nervous to use it because I'm a worrywart. And my biggest concern about it, by the way, I think it's great. Like, I think the fact that genetic testing is clearly a huge part of healthcare and is a huge part of where I think we go with treatments. But we don't have a lot of these treatments yet. And I think what maybe as a paranoid, 40-year-old, I don't know if I want to have this data and sit with it. Although there have been 17 million people who have told me to do it. So I think it's great. And to your point, like, they've really weathered this whole, like, they came out of the gates, you know, pretty much doing it the way they wanted to do it, had to totally retrench. I mean, there aren't many startups that can really claim, you know, on the footstep of disaster only to recover and raise money at this valuation. Like, I do think we should celebrate this. Yeah. I think it's pretty impressive.
Yeah, who else? Like Tesla? And then, I don't know. Like,
well, any Elon Musk company, I feel.
Right, every Elon Musk company.
I tried 23andMe recently, and it's super cool. At first, I was like, I don't need to do this. I already know I'm Jewish. Both my parents did it. They both got Jewish, and I was like, I got... So I already knew that. But it was cool. It was like, first of all, I found out two people I already know happened to be my cousins. I did not know that. That was interesting.
Often and, useful information.
Yeah.
It's the who not to date
right. Right. Fortunately, I had not dated them. But no, so that was interesting info. But also, like, other really bizarre stuff. It was like, you prefer salty foods, and we can tell that by your DNA. So now I don't feel guilty about craving chips and popcorn all the time. No, there's just so many bizarre things.
Well, okay, like, I want another
you
one.
You are a light sleeper. And
keep coming. Give me more.
I don't want to, like, share too much about myself.
Don't share anything that matters.
But there's some really... There was some really bizarre but interesting information and basically confirmed that I don't have, like, rare genetic diseases. That's important, too.
By the way, do you think, like, in 10 years, like, candidates are going to have to post their 23andMe, like, their tax they should be posting their tax returns? I mean, would that be, like, the, you know,
I don't know. I mean,
right?
I mean,
it's pretty important data if you're 80% probable to have some terrible...
No, I don't think they should. I think that, for example, John McCain should still have been allowed to vote in the Senate even when he's recovering from surgery stemming from brain cancer. I think you get elected on your moral character, not on your blood pressure.
Or in theory, you should get elected on your moral character.
Instead of your comb over.
But yeah, I mean, it's definitely an interesting test. And look, there's a huge market for this. There's a lot of people paying to use this service. I mean, apparently I have 1,200 cousins who've done it. So a lot of people have done it. And so
well, also,
the Ancestry DNA also has similar stuff from the Ancestry perspective, not as much health testing, but they're doing well and they filed for IPO.
Well, also at the same time, like, how long is it before Aetna goes to them and says, oh, and also for this coverage plan, we need their 23andMe profile so we can like properly.
Oh, so the insurance demands it in your scenario.
Yeah, so what happens when you join the company? It's like, okay, please sign this document and also submit your 23andMe profile, right? So we can actually get a real risk profile for you for your insurance. I mean, how long is it till that happens?
Hopefully forever. Mine would say, you know, is idiot, you know, predilections, alcoholism. Like, it would just be a sad list of things I don't really want to have written down and shown to me. Like, and you should not hire me because I'm not.
No, it's not about not hiring. It's about properly assessing risk for insurance, right?
But we pool to get past individual differences, right? That's why we have insurance pools. I mean, we're pretty off topic but I think it's a bad idea.
But they might use that type of data. And I think this is why 23andMe is so powerful, because it's like going to be the world's largest patient database where they understand all these correlations. But what they could say is, we need you to get on a certain weight loss plan because per your genetics plus your weight or whatever, we suggest you start on this, you know, pre-diabetic, maybe an Obama health plan, for example, or something like that. I could imagine that happening, right? Like, you know, well, maybe less about changing your rate, and it may be more about encouraging certain behaviors.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, you know, I feel like a lot of health plans will be like, do you smoke? No? Okay, well, ding, $25 off of your health premium, right?
So this is sort of the next step of that.
Yeah, not in a sinister way. Like, I'm not saying, you know, Alex is sitting here giving me the death stare right now. I'm not saying that, you know, you're going to be paying more. It's more like that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I mean, like Geico has this little device they put in your car. It's optional. But they'll lower your rate if you prove to them that you're a good driver. You don't like stop suddenly like I do, or you know you don't drive late at night all the time at 80 miles an hour. Same sort
I
of
want
thing.
To be left alone. I don't want to big data eyes my entire life. I don't want to feed that into corporations for mild discounts. If my company overlords sell me out in that way, I'll go get a different job. Get the hell out of my life.
Well, that's why you're still playing Words with Friends.
No. Before we leave this topic, do they do anything else besides these genetic tests that we all know about so much? Well, do they have other revenue streams?
They're doing a lot of genetic research. I'm not saying they have other revenue streams, but really they're actually using a lot of what people are using with their DNA, but also a lot of self-reported information. Like, they're always sending me surveys, and they're trying to find genetic correlations between certain things, like, and DNA, and trying to spot patterns. And so I think we're actually going to find out a lot of interesting research coming out of 23andMe. I'm not sure exactly what they plan to do with that research, but knowledge is good.
I mean, that's what 23andMe was for several years, was it was an R&D shop. Right. While you're kind of waiting out the FDA and trying to push this through and actually get to the point where you have a consumer product. Right. So, I mean, clearly, you know, if it's able to get this kind of funding, I mean, yeah, it's post FDA. Right. But clearly, if it's able to get this kind of funding, it's like, OK, well, actually, they're good at research. Right. They've actually put together some kind of technology and some database of information, some wealth of information that we think is valuable enough to peg these guys at a 1.7 blah, blah, blah valuation post money, depending on the exact number that it finally comes in at, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think you could even, this may be overstating, but I think you could even say it is a Google-like play, right? Like, the consumer diagnostic is just a front end to get all this amazing data. Once you have all that data, you become insanely valuable. At least that's probably the bet these investors are making, right? That once you popularize a test and you get 50 million people who've taken the test and you have all that data, you're in a pretty powerful position with the health plans, with drug development companies, et cetera.
And a lot of that's opt-in. They ask me questions about whether this my data could be used for research. And they ask me survey questions as well, and I choose whether or not I'm going to answer it. So it's not you can use it and not participate in their studies. But there's one company that actually has raised a lot of funding but isn't doing well, and that is Juicero. We've talked about them on the show before. They're that juice machine. They used to be $700, and they lowered the price to $400. And while I like juice, it's hard to justify spending that kind of money on a machine because you also have to pay for all the juice packets. But they announced this week that they are going to be shutting down. They're actually even going to be providing refunds for some of the people that paid for those machines. Part of their problems stemmed from there was a Bloomberg report earlier this year that showed that you could hand squeeze the juices and it didn't require this fancy machine. And so the machine had already been subject to a lot of ridicule. It was kind of seen as a symbol of Silicon Valley elite, what have you, and funding silly things. And then that survey really kind of pushed things over the edge, which was kind of unfortunate for the company and the employees, but a very interesting, juicy story.
They were squeezed out of the market.
Very important question, though. All right. And this is probably going to be the most important question of the show. Was this blog post posted on Medium?
No, it was posted on their website.
Oh, man.
I mean, maybe it was on Medium as well. I'll have to check that.
I kept thinking, like, oh, my God, this is one Medium post away from, like, a saga, right? Yeah. Like,
I have a question. When Medium eventually shuts down because they can't find a business model, will they post about that on Medium? Sorry.
So one thing that people are talking about is the founder, Doug Evans, was actually at Burning Man when this announcement happened, and he was posting his photos of hanging out there. He was no longer the CEO. So in fairness, he wasn't actually running the company still. But some people didn't think that looked good as his company.
No, it does not look good.
Yeah, I mean, it was just bad timing. I mean, look, I don't know, since he was no longer running it, like, I don't know how much he knew about the timing of the announcement or what have you. But it wasn't a good look. I mean, they've raised so much money, and they only launched last year. They raised $118 million, according to Crunchbase, and big investors like Kleiner Perkins, Google Ventures.
Let's take a quick note in that it's $118 million, which was half the amount of money raised that 23andMe had raised before, or more than half the amount of money that 23andMe had raised before this most recent round.
for a roadster of juice machines.
So I got into a fight about this on Twitter, or a discussion, because I was curious if they were shutting down, realizing that the business was untenable, and they were going to return a bunch of the capital to their investors. Like, look, guys, we made this big bet. We all took a shot on this, and it's obviously not working. So we'll just cut our losses and give you back some of your money. And the responses I got from at least one investor was that, oh, no, that money's gone. Like, there's no expectation that this is going to come back. They're shutting down because they failed, not because they're trying to cut their losses. So that means for Abstract Ventures, Acre Venture Partners, AGO Partners, and, like, all the way down to Vast Ventures.
The Campbell Soup Company and Carmelo Anthony's Mellow 7 Tech. Some interesting names on
Interplay
there.
Ventures, Brian Stibble Investments. I mean, like, the list is huge. It's gone.
Is KP on there? Oh, KP's on there, yeah.
Okay. Of course KP is on there.
I mean, I, from our view, and, I, you know, we publish some of our posts on a very esteemed publication, I believe, called TechCrunch, and, you know, one of the things we often write about is capital efficiency, and I think this is the poster child of not following that at all. Like, I think, you know, there's this belief that if I raise more money, I'll figure out more things. And usually it's the opposite. And I think my sense is I'm not close to this company, but what happened was they tried to scale before they had a product. Like, I'm not even sure they knew what problem they were solving exactly. And they just were like, we got to build a ton of these machines and we got to build hype. And all of a sudden you raise $100 million and you can blow that pretty quickly. So I think it's pretty I think it's pretty terrible management, frankly, to have raised this money, you know, so quickly, spent it so quickly. And I think they took on undue risk. This is why you stage a company. This is why you start with a small amount of capital to get to a certain stage. So, you know, hopefully this is a lesson, frankly, for, you know, our peer group and for, you know, entrepreneurs who think raising more is better. I think, you know, I think you're taking on more risk. And this is a perfect example when you raise so much money.
I mean, so I think part of the problem for companies like this, especially like Juicero, is like you have, I mean, maybe it's a focus on the wrong KPI, right? So, I mean, for something like if you're selling a juice machine, either you sold the juice machine or didn't sell the juice machine, right? I mean, maybe they should have been focusing on some other like metric, like, I don't know, weekly active rejuicers or something like that, right? But it's a question of, you know, if you're trying to mass produce something and get it out the door as fast as possible, maybe you're trying to set yourself up for retail partnerships and getting it into a Target or something like that. But it starts from figuring out what your objective is and like a objective that's active, that's easily measurable, that has some, you know, metric of success that means that, oh yeah, actually I'm moving towards a profitable company, right?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, but my suspicion is a lot of the justification was we're going big, and like peeling that back to like what those metrics are. You know, you hear that a lot, right? We're just going big. We want these in every house, in every business. And you know, to your point, like, okay, but let's. Where do we start? Do we start in one region? Do we start with one group of consumers? Like, it sort of seemed like they raised all this money overnight, and then they were trying to do a massive launch. And I think that's very hard for a product like this.
Yeah, I mean,
how long did it take Keurig to get mainstream?
Exactly. Sorry, that's what I was about to mention. Is Keurig like the coffee cups that a lot of people are using? That has become popular enough that a lot of VCs are trying to find the next big kitchen appliance that can become a regular use case. And they felt that there is a large market opportunity for juice because, I mean, I actually drink a lot of juice, so do a lot of people I know. I mean, it is a popular thing in certain communities, and they were hoping that they could make this more efficient for people, that they don't have to go to a store and buy juice, and that they don't have to use a blender, and that they could just make it more easily. But the problem is they had a bad go-to-market strategy. They didn't do their launch very well. They had bad PR. They just really had a lot of failed strategies from the get-go, and so it didn't work out well.
Well, I mean, the other question that I have is, like, so Keurig was a successful company, went after coffee and did really well, and they also went after like Coke and Diet Coke. That's and that right, did yeah. not work, right? So I mean, you know, when I looked at this, and you're looking at the scope of Keurig, and Keurig, you know, tried to go after make a product that was equivalent to Coca-Cola, which is like a massive company, right? It's a publicly traded company. You'd expect if you wanted to scope that to juice, it's like, well, actually, maybe there's not actually a market for juice, right?
But I think to Katie's point, I think it's a failure of execution. Like, there may have been a market for these juicing machines, and they may have been able to build a great business, you know, just as Peloton has. I mean, you wouldn't think there's like necessarily a massive business for that. They've built a great business, but I think it's a failure of execution. I think Keurig took probably 15 or 20 years. Remember, Starbucks didn't sign up initially for Keurig. Like, it took a while for that to become mainstream. And I think that, like to try to just go shoot the moon out of the gate, like this just would have taken time. It's not a lot of these businesses don't go like Facebook or Uber or Google, and you can't fund them that way. You can't fund a juice company, in my opinion, and put rocket fuel in this thing, hoping it's going to become Google in 3 years. It's just not how consumer products
work. Google didn't become Google in 3 years.
And Google didn't become Google that quickly.
And to summarize Lindley's point, Coca-Cola is now worth $194 billion, and Juicera was worth zero.
And on that note, thank you for tuning in. Come back next week.
Become a weekly active rejuicer.
All right, everyone. We want to say a special thanks to our producer, TechCrunch's own Christopher Gates, our executive producer, Henry Picavet. Thank you to Katie Roof. Thank you to Matthew Lindley. And thank you to you for leaving us that 5-star iTunes review. That's Equity. We'll see you all next Friday.